Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. One of Kentucky's biggest bourbon-producing counties is looking to turn off the whiskey spigot, at least for now, and others are having similar thoughts. That sentence, unimaginable in Kentucky until only very recently, begins an article in the Lexington Herald Leader by Janet Patton and Austin Horn about local fallout after the state legislature voted over the objections of county leaders to phase out the bourbon barrel tax that raises millions for county budgets. Governor Andy Beshear signed the bill into law on March 31st, setting things in motion for the tax to phase out beginning in 2026. Janet Patton is here in the studio, and Austin Horn, who is out on assignment, joins us by phone. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
First of all, for those who haven't followed this, or maybe they're just passing through and they're listening to us, if you could give us a brief tutorial on the bourbon barrel tax.
Well, it's the property tax that's on the aging whiskey in the barrels in a distillery warehouse. So for the first 2 years, there's no tax on the whiskey. But then after that, and every year after that, for as long as it's in the warehouse, distilleries have been paying this tax.
And how long does a barrel usually remain in a warehouse?
It varies. Most of the time, barrels are used probably about by 7 years, but it can be in much longer. I think, you know, based on age statements we've seen on bourbon bottles on the shelves now, you're seeing 10, 15. So it can be quite a long time.
And so that generates a lot of revenue.
Yeah, over the years it does.
Any figure on that, how much revenue is generated?
Well, it's been going up for the last few years. Right now, it's at $40 million. And the bourbon distillers lobby estimates that within 6 or 7 years, it will double again.
How many counties in Kentucky does this apply to?
At least 28 right now. And, you know, there could have applied to more because the bourbon industry is growing all the time.
It's really expanding these days, isn't it?
Yep.
Austin, question for you. You have the Frankfurt end of this conversation and this story. How did the bourbon industry lobby justify ending this tax?
And before I get to that, I just want to point out that local communities don't have too many taxation options, and this is really the primary way they get money from these bourbon companies who make really big investments in their communities, but truth be told, don't hire very many people relative to their amount of investment just because it's a pretty low overhead kind of industry. How many people do you need to watch barrels that are just sitting and aging? But to answer the lobbying question, I think a big theme that I heard in Frankfurt is that this stifles startups and innovation in Kentucky, because if you think about it in the grand scheme of things, the tax that a company like Buffalo Trace or Woodford Reserve is putting into these communities, it's really chicken feed relative to the overall amount of money that they bring in. But for a startup distillery that has not launched a product just yet that is paying tax on bourbon that is aging, that number is much higher relative to any gains that they've seen materialize. So the startup thing is the main sort of discussion for advocates. And they're also saying that this is an anti-competitive tax that is unique to Kentucky, and that other states like Indiana, Tennessee, New York, where we're seeing distilleries, just don't have this.
So when the industry is saying that it stifles growth, they're mainly talking about the startups. Is that right? Because otherwise, the industry is undergoing record growth of distilleries, warehouses, and profits right now.
Yeah, that's right. Governor Beshear has highlighted this repeatedly every time he makes another economic announcement. And the KDA, the Kentucky Distillers Association, in fact, testified to lawmakers about this over the summer. They have put, I think, more than $2 billion, that's billion with a B. They made more than $2 billion in announcements last year, and they've got more than $3 billion in projects projected for the next 5 years. So, yeah, booming is kind of an understatement.
Many of these distilleries are now owned by big international corporations. Is that right? Little connection to the local communities?
It's kind of split. So Heaven Hill, which is probably the biggest that people don't really think of as much, it's Evan Williams, it's Elijah Craig. That's still owned by the Shapiro family. Brown-Forman, which is publicly traded, is still controlled by the family and still headquartered in Louisville. But Campari, which is in Italy, owns Wild Turkey and just bought Wilderness Trail, which is in Danville. Buffalo Trace in 1792, owned by Sazerac, which is based in New Orleans. But Jim Beam, Maker's Mark, and Four Roses are all owned by Japanese companies.
In addition to sunsetting the barrel tax itself, does this bill also allow distilleries to claw back another almost $200 million in taxes from the state?
It does. Yeah, the figure is $192 million, according to a fiscal note done with the bill. And these facilities and these companies were already used to tax breaks. But one of the issues under discussion with House Bill 5 was that they weren't able to access those as much anymore because their tax situation had changed. So the bill assured them that they would be able to still claw back a decent amount. And the bill did get a compromise late in the game to help shore up school budgets, but that still leaves local counties and cities who got this revenue sort of out to dry.
Well, Janet, we talked about how many counties this applies to before, but am I right in saying that most of the world's bourbon comes from five of those counties? Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, five Kentucky counties hold most of the bourbon: Franklin, Woodford, Marion, Nelson, and Bullitt. They're not all big bourbon makers. Like, a lot of bourbon is actually made in Jefferson County. And, of course, Anderson County has two distilleries as well. But there are warehouses scattered throughout Kentucky, and it's growing. I mean, there were projects announced for a wide variety of counties all over the state in the last year.
Well, now, the Kentucky Distillers Association claims that without this tax break, distillers will just go to other states. And, of course, that really touches a nerve here in Kentucky, which has long prided in being the global epicenter of bourbon production. But this time around, judging by the comments in your article, county leaders are not moved by that threat. What are they saying?
Yeah, it was really striking to hear that in Nelson County, the judge executive, Tim Hutchins, is asking for a moratorium on new building, that he wants to give the county a chance to reconsider a zoning change that they made that basically exempts a lot of new bourbon growth, a lot of new bourbon warehouses from any kind of approvals. He wants them to reconsider that, which could mean that there are no more. And, you know, that sounds, you know, mind-boggling, but Bullitt says basically the same thing. Jerry Summers, who's the judge executive there, said, yeah, we don't want more of these because now they've become a net loss for us. They don't bring in enough jobs, and we're out money for water lines, sewer lines. And I think he emphasized, and a lot of people don't realize this, that the amount of fire protection that bourbon warehouses require is very expensive. Road repairs as well. And in Marion County, which is where Maker's Mark and Bullitt have warehouses, and soon Pernod Ricard will have a whole other distillery, their judge executive said that without the barrel taxes, the warehouses are just a bad deal.
We hear a lot these days about what's called whiskey fungus. It's a mold that is associated with distilling. Do those operations that are impacted include mitigating issues such as whiskey fungus?
I think for a lot of the counties, it's been a trade-off, a bargain. You know, they've been willing to put up with things like whiskey fungus and these other costs in return for the revenue. And that seems to be changing now.
You know, when I read your story, something really leapt off the page to me, Janet and Austin, and that is what I think is a parallel here between the barrel tax and the coal severance tax. By taxing each ton of coal dug out of the mountains of eastern Kentucky, revenues were generated for local governments. They relied on those revenues to make ends meet. until the decline of mining. And with that, those tax revenues declined as well. And that left many of those counties among the poorest in the country.
I think they definitely have that kind of thing on their minds, because one of the things that really struck me was how burned some of these counties feel at having given prime economic development spots to distilleries when they would have saved them for auto plants or other economic opportunities that would bring in many more jobs that they could use as another base of revenue for their county. And instead, they're stuck with now a distillery or a bourbon warehouse that's going to generate very little revenue for the county.
Both of you are watching this. I'm just wondering, do you think, is this it? Is it over? Or do you think that we have not heard the last of this?
I don't think so. Do you, Austin?
No. I think the General Assembly, and you mentioned coal, I think another industry worth bringing in this discussion is the horse industry. The General Assembly, both Democrats and Republicans, but it's controlled by Republicans now, has pretty reliably acted on, I guess you could say, the will of both of these industries. So I think we will see more done in Frankfurt to bolster the bourbon industry. And I think it's also worth just reiterating that the counties that are kind of standing up to the industry that Janet detailed, it makes sense from their perspective to do so. And they have some leverage here, right? A Maker's Mark is not going to move its campus to Indiana, the campus that it, you know, so carefully built and is a tourist attraction. Buffalo Trace isn't going to move out of Frankfurt. So they do have some leverage here, and, you know, we'll see if they can change minds in the legislative body. It's hard to foresee that happening now, but with potentially new leadership, that could change.
What's your sense of it, Janet? Do the counties have recourse?
I think they do. I think some of them are looking at other fees, other methods of finding a way to get some of the revenue back. They can't do without it. I mean, that's the whole point, is collectively, I think they were looking at something like $18 million that they get. So that's all the counties. So they can't just forego that revenue. And I don't think most citizens are going to be happy with having higher property taxes year after year to make up for the loss of this other revenue. School districts do have a bit of a reprieve because of the compromise that Austin alluded to. But if you're thinking this is just something that impacts a handful of counties, then you need to be aware that that money will come out of overall the state budget. So it's locked into a fixed rate. The counties will never receive less. But once the distilleries stop paying the tax, the rest of us will have to make up the difference over time.
That's an important distinction. So the counties will continue to receive revenue?
The schools will. The school districts will continue to receive a revenue rate that will be locked in, I think, in 2026. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be a pretty high revenue rate. And then the money coming from the distilleries will fall away. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Austin, it's set up to come out of the rainy day fund at this point.
Yeah,
but, you know, eventually that's just all the taxpayers. That's just the rest of us. We'll have to make up the difference to school districts in a handful of counties. Well, 20 counties, 20 plus counties.
And the other part of this is the revenue that would have gone into infrastructure and to emergency services and so forth. That is directly impacted.
Absolutely.
Do the counties have any how independent are they? Can they establish their own taxes on barrels or some aspect of the industry?
That's a very good question. I know some of them are looking at some measures, but you have to realize that in some counties, for instance, there's no zoning. In some counties, there's no fire district to tap. There are mechanisms, but they're starting in some places from ground zero. So it could take a while to sort out other ways that they can make up this revenue.
All right. Very interesting. Janet Patton and Austin Horam of the Lexington Herald Leader. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Back in a moment with community-supported agriculture, Weeda Michael on Farm to Table, Kentuckians who plant by the signs, and...
insects, and not just pollinators, are declining, and that has some real implications, obviously, for the function of the natural world that we depend on.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
I'm Brian Burkhart with coming events provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The Richmond Area Arts Council, EKU Center for the Arts, Madison County Schools, and Berea Independent Schools will present Art Expo 2023, 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. daily, April 25th through the 27th, in the lobby of the EKU Center for the Arts in Richmond. For more information, visit artsinrichmond.org. The Kentucky Arts Council will host the Governor's Derby exhibit from April 20th through May 16th at the State Capitol in Frankfort. The exhibit's theme is resilience. The Governor's Derby exhibit is open to the public during regular Capitol visiting hours. And don't forget about Kentucky Writers' Day, April 24th at the Capitol Rotunda in Frankfort. Celebrate Kentucky's rich literary tradition and meet the soon-to-be-appointed Kentucky Poet Laureate for 2023 and 2024. For information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're back with the edible portion of our program. Here's the first course. Brooke Gentile is Executive Director of OAK, the Organic Association of Kentucky, and Katie Harvey is the organization's Workplace Wellness and Community-Supported Agriculture Program Coordinator. So who better to talk to about tapping into and supporting sources of locally grown fresh foods than Brooke and Katie? Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Well, let's begin with a basic for anybody who might not be aware. What is community-supported agriculture? How does it work? Katie, what can you tell us?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. You said it already, but CSA stands for Community-Supported Agriculture. So it's an acronym. It's all about community and supporting local agriculture. So when you sign up for a CSA, you're signing up for a weekly or biweekly or monthly portion of a farm's harvest. And the main difference that makes CSA unique is you're signing up for it in advance of the growing season. And CSA shares can be for produce, for eggs, for meat or flowers or other farm products. But you buy a portion of it up front. You commit to a certain number of weeks. You share in that risk and reward of the growing season with the farm that you're working with or the farms. And then you also get to develop that relationship with your partner farms or your farm. You know, it's a great way to support the local food system, one of the main food system channels. So we love talking about it.
Our radio signal reaches two regions of Kentucky, Central Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky. And so we have listeners in both areas. So I'm wondering, I don't know if you can put a number on this, but how big is the CSA community in the region that we cover?
I would say the Central Kentucky region has probably one of the largest kind of CSA networks of farms. If I had to guess, and this is just an estimate, I would say, you know, upwards of more than, you know, 30 to, you know, more than 30 farms are serving like kind of the greater Lexington area. And, you know, it's a pretty robust network. And I can pitch it to Brooke here to kind of weigh in and see what she thinks as well.
Yeah, I think that tracks. And one thing to remember is that farms do distribute often to their local communities, and then they might travel a little bit to like a nearby urban center and distribute shares there as well. There's some great resources to find a CSA farm near you, both the OAK directory, but also the KDA, Kentucky Department of Agriculture directory, offer resources for you to find the CSA farm near you that offers products that you might like. It's definitely what we've seen, though, and a lot of new CSA farms have started in the past handful of years to meet this growing consumer demand for a variety of reasons.
What other trends are on your radar right now?
Yeah, and I can take that one, Tom. This is Katie. So for listeners that are just tuning in, we're talking about CSA or community supported agriculture. Oftentimes we like to think of that as like a local food subscription. And this type of subscription-based model from a local farm really surged in popularity in 2020. You know, when COVID threatened the traditional supply chain, we just saw a big surge in CSA signups nationally as well as across Kentucky. We've always known, you know, local food is a shorter supply chain. It's a more resilient supply chain. And we definitely saw that with COVID. And there was a lot more farms entering the CSA space in the last, you know, couple years, pivoting from maybe restaurant sales or wholesale or farmers market to CSA. But a lot of those farms have kind of stayed in the CSA space, even as we kind of reached a new normal with COVID. There's been a big increase in home delivery of CSA shares, you know, kind of direct to the consumer, but even closer, you know, making it as easy as possible to connect with a farm, and an increase in kind of multi-farm or maybe aggregated CSA shares. If farms maybe don't have enough product to put together a share themselves, they'll work with other farms to do that. And then a lot of farms kind of jumping on and using more software-based kind of tools so members can customize their CSA or pause their share on vacation and just to make it a little bit more flexible. So those are, you know, a lot of things that we're seeing in the space.
And Katie, what is the Kentucky Farm Share Coalition?
So that is a program of OAK. It is our workplace CSA voucher program. It's a farmer-led coalition. We bring CSA directly to employees and help employers offer incentives to make it more affordable and convenient to sign up for a share. So a lot of the tools that we use to do that are we help employers offer a sponsored kind of discount on a share, what we like to call a voucher, so they can put money towards the food itself and make it a little bit more affordable for the employee. They can offer payroll deduction, and we help kind of facilitate those two, as well as helping create like an on-site pickup so they can pick it up at work, or just share that opportunity and promote community pickup. So lots of ways that we kind of help employers promote the local farms in their area and help their employees access fresh foods on a more regular basis.
That's great. How many employers are signed up for this?
Yeah, in 2022, we worked with 16 employers. We had 7 partner farms that we were working with in our coalition, and we're kind of growing that number. We have 8 partner farms this year, and it's been across the state. So we are working in the central Kentucky area, but we're also working in northern Kentucky, in the Louisville area, in the eastern Kentucky area, we have farms. So just trying to kind of cast a wide network. And we really see CSA as a great fit for wellness programming because it's kind of built in. You know, CSA is a regular box of, in this case, vegetables. And that really helps people that participate build a healthy routine or maintain their healthy routine over the long term. And we got an opportunity to work with University of Kentucky on a lot of CSA research. And that research has been pretty powerful to kind of tell the story of, you know, when you participate in CSA, you spend less on prescriptions, you go to the doctors less, you overall kind of feel healthier. And they've seen some also changes in like the actual data and biometrics, which is really cool.
This is Brooke. There's one important thing to know for Kentuckians is that fewer than 6% of Kentucky adults eat the daily recommended number of vegetable servings, right? So there's a lot we can all do to make sure that we're both accessing really healthy foods and produce. And any way we can do it that makes it easy and convenient will up our chances of hitting those daily recommended servings.
You know, I'm hearing something here that's really interesting to me. I'm a longtime CSA subscriber and pretty much have done it the traditional way. Every week, go pick it up. But it sounds like the industry, if you will, or the organization is making it much easier for the consumer by delivering to the workplace, by doing home deliveries. Am I right about that? Has there been a big change?
Tom, this is Katie. Yes, there definitely has been. I mean, I think CSA is more convenient and easy to participate in than it ever has been. And, you know, that's something that we're really championing because, you know, the more folks we can bring into this kind of movement and space, the more folks that are able to access this healthy food. And we really feel like, you know, there's so many benefits of CSA and kind of it's a pretty unique model. And I think if folks aren't familiar, just knowing the history of CSA and where it started really gets at some of the core values of CSA. You know, at the end of the day, it's all about relationships. It started as a radical way to purchase food outside the normal supply chain. It started to help small family farms thrive. And Booker T. Whatley, who is a Black horticulturist, he's had a long and prolific career at Tuskegee University. He actually started one of the very first CSA programs in the U.S. back in the 1960s, and it was for struggling Black farmers. He called that the clientele membership clubs, where customers paid up front for a season of food. And it was really to guarantee business for the farm and secure funding outside of the traditional loan or bank sources. So, you know, one of the main benefits when you're doing a CSA is you're really offering that farm more security because they know that you're going to be a season-long customer. So I think that's like a pretty core value and what makes CSA so special.
And Tom, this is Brooke. To your point, the CSA model is nimble and so unique that it does continue to evolve, as you noted. And today it's really providing an important direct farm-to-community member market channel that is radical and both beneficial to the farm and to the CSA member, and really to our agrarian rural economies as well.
I spotted the 2022 Field Day summaries on your website. And by the way, if you're curious about or interested in this business, you might want to visit this page where you'll find firsthand accounts around topics from small-scale, multi-species organic farming to CSA planning, record keeping, and marketing. Anyway, a headline on this page caught my attention. It says, "Building a successful market farm with low capital, minimal infrastructure, and leased land." In this case, the subject is Modern Heritage Farm in Hardin County, which is owned and operated by Jessica and John Thomas Hodges. Low capital, minimal infrastructure, and leased land. That sounds like a proposition that would require a whole lot of courage and determination. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, Tom, this is Brooke. I'm happy to answer this one. I will say, you know, farming of any size and any amount of infrastructure is takes courage, honestly, particularly when you're thinking about farming in the Kentucky climate these days, from drought to flood to straight line winds. Farmers are really on the forefront of climate change, and particularly when you're thinking about small family farms or beginning farmers or limited resourced farmers or socially disadvantaged farmers, they're going into that very challenging profession without a lot of resources behind them. And so, you know, OAK provides field days that really tries to unlock the knowledge and resources that farmers need to thrive, and that social connectivity. And I'll say we're not doing this alone. There are a lot of other organizations in the state that are similarly providing information and resources and connecting farmers to the tools that they need to have thriving businesses. So it does take a lot of people and organizations working together to make sure that that our local food systems are thriving, not the least of whom are farmers that are committing, you know, their lives and their businesses to this enterprise. So,
to me, to be a farmer, you basically have to be a scientist.
100%, Tom. Yes, you have to be curious. You have to be a scientist. You have to know your neighbors. You have to be a problem solver. You have to be willing for long, hard days. Right. And you have to be a marketer, you have to be a business person, you have to be all those things. And there are a lot of opportunities where you can, through your farmer networks and through connecting with organizations, you can find some of those resources and you can do more together. So that's part of why OAK is here, doing what we're doing, responding to what farmers need. And that's what a lot of other partner organizations are responding to as well.
All right, that's Brooke Gentile, Executive Director of the Organic Association of Kentucky, or OAK, and Katie Harvey, OAK's Workplace Wellness and Community Supported Agriculture Program Coordinator. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
The belief that phases of the moon and astrological signs play powerful roles in the growth and well-being of crops may be written off by many as superstitious, but generations of Appalachian gardeners and farmers have sworn by the practice and continue to this day. And now there's a wonderfully illustrated book about it, Sown in the Stars by Sarah Hall, an associate professor of agriculture and natural resources at Berea College.
While I was working at Kentucky State University, I was out at the working at the research farm there, and I had a gentleman stop by and give me some seeds, and he told me that if I planted them under a certain sign, they would go about an inch deeper in the soil at any other time. And I don't remember exactly when he said that I should plant them, but I just remember that interaction, and I kind of stuck those seeds in my seed box and kind of forgot about them. But then a number of years later, while teaching here at Berea College and developing a new class called Appalachian Plants and People, when I was looking through the Foxfire books, I ran across in the first Foxfire book, there's a chapter on this topic, and then there's also a small section in Foxfire 11 that touches on it. And I was sort of surprised not to find more written research on the subject, or, you know, videos. You know, there's nothing from Apple Shop, for instance, that focuses on it, even though I've heard about it a lot. And I know that, you know, many people are still doing it. So that's kind of what the project came out of.
Illustrated by Heather Dent and photographer Meg Wilson, with a foreword by author and editor Ronnie Lundy, whose work focuses on traditional Southern foods, Sown in the Stars is a collection of interviews with farmers in central and eastern Kentucky who follow the signs of the moon and stars to guide planting, harvesting, canning and food preservation, butchering, and just general farm work.
If the sign is in, the moon's phase is in the dark of the moon, it's good for planting crops that develop underground. And if it's light and the light moon, and it's good for crops growing above ground.
Gary and Goldie Easton were interviewed on their farm in Gallatin County.
I would say even those individuals that aren't farming now but did farm like we did years ago are probably still interested in the signs, whether farming or just a small garden. And the reason why I say that is because I don't believe the article in the county paper would continue to exist, which is entitled Planting by the Signs. If no one was reading it, you know, they probably wouldn't publish it. Mm-hmm. So I think that community is still looking to the old ways.
A lot of people in the mountains still plant by the signs.
Bill Best, creator and former director of the North Carolina-based Sustainable Mountain Agriculture Center, another among those featured in Dr. Hall's book. If you're into heirloom seed saving in Appalachia, you probably heard of Bill Best.
Waxing of the moon is when you plant the seeds, the plants that grow above ground, and the waning of the moon is when you plant the ones that are the root crops that grow underground.
As Gary Easton points out, sometimes nature has other plans.
You know, the sign might be right on Thursday and Friday to plant potatoes, but if you just had 2 inches of rain, you may have to wait a week, and then the sign is not as good.
On the other hand,
2014, the signs were right for planting sweet potatoes. That fall in September, we harvested a bumper crop of sweet potatoes. We had one potato that weighed 9 pounds and 4 ounces. I took it to the county paper. It was in the county news.
Sarah Hall is a scientist. Her focuses are on agriculture and natural resources. So it might seem unusual for a scientist to explore the intersection of astronomy and astrology.
Calendar that is used, most of the calendars and almanacs that people use to do this are actually astrological, where the 12 zodiac constellations are just evenly divided up 30 degree slices of sort of the pie. But there are some that are astronomical, primarily the biodynamic almanac or calendar. That one is actually based on where the stars are in the sky, and occasionally they line up with one another. And so there definitely is a link of the two, and I talk about this fairly extensively in the first chapter of the book.
Is there science that supports the idea that the moon's effect on gravity plays a role?
Certainly, you know, we know that the moon's impact on water is why we get diurnal tides. And the idea here is that the impact of the moon and differences in its placement could play a role on water, even in something as small as a seed or in water in the soil or that sort of thing.
Well, it's a wonderful book, Sarah. And it also kind of reminds us how much we've lost touch with these connections that have been there for, you know, for generations and generations.
Yeah, it's so easy for us now to live in a way that is very disconnected from what is going on around us. And, you know, I guess going into this, my thinking is that any effort to get us looking up in the sky, thinking a little bit more about the natural sort of cycles that are happening around us, you know, there's nothing negative to come out of that.
Sarah Hall, Associate Professor of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Berea College and author of the book Sown in the Stars, published by the University Press of Kentucky. And our thanks to Berea College Special Collections and Archives for those clips from Sarah's conversations with Gary Easton and Bill Best. I want to welcome Weta Michael back to Eastern Standard. And in case you just arrived in Central Kentucky, Weta owns and operates 8 local restaurants, a catering business, and a bar, among other things. She's been written up in the New York Times, Southern Living, Garden and Gun, and has appeared on the Food Network and the Cooking Channel. She has an armload of awards to her credit, but one in particular gets to what we want to talk about, and that is the Bluegrass Tomorrow Josephine Abercrombie Award, the group's most prestigious honor, given to a person who contributes tirelessly to improve quality of life in the bluegrass. So this is a very, very busy, locally devoted person we have on the line with us. And I got in touch with Weta for this focus on local agriculture because she has always made locally grown ingredients a priority in her restaurants. So thanks for taking a moment for us, Weta.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And so why do you place an emphasis on locally sourced ingredients?
Well, for me, there is no real expression of Kentucky cuisine without the Kentucky farmer. What makes Kentucky's cuisine so special and stand out so much is the family farm community of Kentucky and what they produce.
Well, from a restaurant business perspective, wouldn't it be easier and less of a hit to the bottom line to just buy from traditional restaurant suppliers?
Well, you know, one thing, it may have been some 25 years ago, but today, honestly, with the investments that Kentucky's made with the Kentucky Department of Agriculture and the legislature with the development of the Kentucky Proud brand, we lead the country in the investment that we made to help our farmers diversify once the tobacco crop stopped having a tobacco base. Once we got into that tobacco settlement money, our farmers were able to get the support they needed to diversify and sustain that small family farm. Since I've been buying local, you know, it used to be there was one processor in the entire state. There's multiple processors now. And with the University of Kentucky's requirement of Aramark to buy local foods and get that kind of revenue stream going through the local food production market, it's really helped sustain processing in terms of beef, pork, lamb, chicken, and actually increase it. So today, it's very easy for chefs to order local from a distributor like Creation Garden and use it on their menus. And there's rebate money available through the Buy Local program for Kentucky Proud. So I feel like the only other thing I'll say is that through the pandemic or the supply chain disruption that we saw, we did not experience. I have the same farmer. I have almost a 20-year relationship with a farmer that does all of our ground beef, our pork, our bacon, our sausage, and that'd be Patrick Kennedy out of Stonecross Farms. And he sustained us and with no major price increases. So we work together hand in glove to keep each other afloat, and you don't have that kind of buy-in from big broadline companies.
That's really interesting. So two-part question for you, Weta. What are the benefits from the kitchen perspective and also then from the person who's sitting out in your dining room and enjoying a meal?
Well, from a kitchen's operations perspective, I think there are multiple benefits. One is obviously taste, quality, and consistency. When you're buying produce from a giant warehouse, you have no idea when it was picked or how long it's been stored in refrigerated or unrefrigerated temperatures and then trucked across the country. That's going to reduce flavor and also reduce shelf life. But when I'm buying from my local growers and storing it myself, I know exactly when it was picked. I know how long it's been in my refrigerator. I can control the conditions from the point of harvest to the time it gets to your table. So for food safety reasons, for taste reasons, all kinds of ways for that, it's really great for kitchen operations. I think it does distinguish our food from other people's food. You're not going to be able to get a Kentucky-grown salad at McDonald's, that's for sure, but you can get it at any one of our restaurants. We sell thousands of pounds of Kentucky-grown lettuces every year, all year long. From a customer standpoint, the nutritional content of the food is much higher. The taste is much better. So I feel like you're getting a much better quality product. But also every dollar that you spend on a local ingredient, on a local hamburger, you know, out of like $2 or $3 of that price point is going back to Kentucky farmer. It's not going to a company or somebody, some crazy middleman. It's going to a Kentucky farm family. So we consume 100,000 pounds of local ground beef in our restaurants. So that's like $500,000. That money is going to farming families in Kentucky. And the other reason that I do it is because, honestly, I want to reduce every impact environmentally that our restaurants can have. So the restaurant industry can be somewhat wasteful. There's a lot of trash involved. There's a lot of expenditure of resources. One thing that we can do is shorten our supply chain so we super shorten transportation costs, energy expenses, climate impacts, all of that by using locally produced goods.
Well, you cited your meat source, and I'm just wondering, when you need, let's say, a lot of arugula, do you have a go-to farm for that and other go-tos for other ingredients?
Well, as our company has grown, you know, you said we have 9 locations. What we started doing was aggregating our own farming, local ingredients, because and so we hire a person, and her name doing this for us, her name's Kelly Sebastian, and she's one of our staff members. So she goes to she has all these different farming contacts, and they email her and tell her what they have, and she compiles a list and sends it out to our chefs, and she buys in for the whole company, and then she takes it out to Honeyward or takes it downtown to Zim's or at Holly Hill, actually, we're producing a lot of our own goods in our big gardens out there, but she'll ship stuff to Holly Hill as well. And that's how, you know, our restaurants are really busy, and having that local, you know, that staff member that can help the chefs get that local food in their back door has really been amazing. So that's kind of how our structure works.
Okay. Do you have any do and don't advice for farm-to-table producers who might be looking to up their game by supplying restaurants?
You know, I know farmers have had a lot of frustration in the past talking to chefs because a chef might be at a restaurant for a short period of time and then leave. Where I really got bitten by this bug and learned how to do it was I used to work at Dedley's restaurant way back in the day, like 30 years ago. And to me, the smartest thing Debbie Long ever did, she owns Dudley's, was she made a commitment. Not the chef did too, but she made an owner's commitment to using local produce at that time. So the farmers that were selling to Dudley's knew that it was the owner that they had the commitment from, not a chef that'd be migrating. So I do recommend farmers really try to work with owners to show them the products, not just the chef, but show them what they've got, explain to them the market benefits. And then the other thing that I highly recommend to farmers is understand how restaurants have to price their food. One of the common things that happens to me is somebody wants to sell me, let's say, organic broccoli for $5 a pound. Well, I can't resell it to my clients at that price. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand how a chef calculates their food cost and what those margins are. And I think if you do understand that, it helps you price your own goods. And you don't necessarily have to have a wholesale price, but you have to have a price on something that a chef can turn around and sell again to a customer.
Well, kind of a shift of gears here, but I'm just curious if you are noticing effects of climate change among the farms that you work with. For example, we just read today that we've had the earliest spring on record this year.
Yeah. 100%, and I've been noticing it for several years because I think you probably have been too. One of my favorite things about Central Kentucky is our orchard community and how many fantastic orchards we have. Well, the second we have these really warm Februarys and Marches, I just live in fear because I know that those little tender apple blossoms and peach blossoms are going to come popping out, and then we're going to have a hard freeze and lose all of our fruit crops. And I think you're seeing that in Kentucky. But yes, we have seen the impacts of climate. I think last year we had an incredibly good growing season. It was such a good growing season that I think farmers really got tired and nobody could handle planting a fall crop because the spring and summer crops had been so intense, the cold weather, everybody needed to take a rest. Huh. So we didn't have as much cold weather cropping come in. But our growing seasons are going to change some here in Kentucky. I think they already have started.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I let you go, I want to give you some congratulations. I understand you were just appointed by the State Department to the American Culinary Corps, which is, as I understand it, a diplomatic culinary partnership between the State Department and the James Beard Foundation. What's that all about?
Yes. I am so excited by this. I have my first big meeting coming up in a week, and I hope I get assigned. It's a soft diplomacy project that the State Department has embarked in for years. And so it's not like I'm going to be making dinner for Vladimir Putin. I have a few choice things I'd like to feed that guy. but at the same time, if a diplomat needs help with a soft diplomacy and softening up and getting people to understand the American culture through food, that's what we're there for. And it's chefs, 80 chefs from across the country in all walks of life, you know, lots of Native American chefs, every state represented, all different kinds of cultures. It's a real melting pot, and it's a true honor to be included. So I just hope I get to go cook somewhere exciting.
Well, congratulations again. That sounds like so much fun, and it'll be fun for us just to kind of watch what goes on.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Tom.
Weta Michael, whose constellation of local eateries includes Holly Hill Inn, Wallace Station, Windy Corner Market, Smithtown Seafood, Honeywood, the Midway Bakery, Zim's Cafe. It just goes on and on. Thanks so much, Weta. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thanks for all your reporting. It's wonderful. I want you to know I'm a devoted listener.
Oh, I so appreciate that. Thank you very much. We want to introduce a new member of the Eastern Standard team. You'll be hearing from Crystal Jones in the weeks and the months ahead, beginning with a question taking on new weight as we look for ways to reduce the human impact on our climate.
To mow or not to mow, that is the question. As I stand before my uncut lawn on a sunny mid-April morning, I'm considering the amount of work in maintaining a well-manicured lawn and the growing number of lawn care-related environmental concerns, including pesticides and water usage. Many lawn owners, including myself, have begun considering more environmentally friendly alternatives to a manicured lawn. My quest for a more eco-friendly lawn has led me to Sustainable Berea. I'm meeting with agronomist and program director Richard Olson, who, when I arrive, is feeding Tucker, a street-savvy tuxedo cat who has made the Berea Urban Farm his home.
The mission of the Berea Urban Farm is to increase food security and build community through urban agriculture. And when we define community, it's maybe a little more broadly in that we include all the other species in the soil and the land and all. And so trying to build a healthy community involves all those aspects, not just the people.
We head inside the offices located in a small yellow house tucked into the corner of the farm. I wanted to know more about how I could transform my lawn into a more natural and sustainable space.
So if we look at the typical lawn, it's a desert for a bee. I mean, that grass is nothing that a bee can use. And there's a lot of lawn in this country. There's about 50,000 square miles.
So what are the alternatives? There are four major types of eco-friendly options. First, you have your naturalized or unmowed turf grass gone wild. Or you can do a low-growing turf grass that requires little grooming, like replacing or mixing your turf with clover. There's a natural or naturalized landscape where the turf is replaced with native plants as well as non-native climate-friendly ones that can thrive in your local conditions. Or there are the yards with edible plants, vegetables, and fruit. Sustainable Berea provides instructions and resources to help you choose the right setup and offers classes to get you started with the project. A more natural native lawn is not only less maintenance and less prone to drought, but in regard to climate change, it's crucial to our pollinators.
You hear different numbers, but at least one out of every three bites of food we have owes its existence to pollinators.
In fact, he says, insects are declining at a rate of around 2% a year in population.
But when I was a kid, we would go for a drive on a summer's evening, and we'd have to pull into a gas station. And somebody would come out to put gas in your car, and they'd offer to wash your windshield. And that was necessary because the windshield was just covered with bug splatters. So think about it now as you drive around. Your windshield's clean at the end of the drive. I mean, the insects just aren't there anymore. Insects, and not just pollinators, are declining, and that has some real implications, obviously, for the function of the natural world that we depend on.
You will want to decide how much of an area you're going to devote to your project. Even replacing half or portions of your lawn can make a difference. And if you don't have a lawn, raised beds or container gardens are also an option. Although I have a sizable lawn, I do rent, so I'm going with a couple of 25-gallon tubs. These tubs are gathered for the Berea Urban Farm through a partnership with the Madison County Conservation District to keep these former plastic cow feed tubs out of landfills. The fertilizer is bagged by volunteers of Winnie the Pooh in Versailles, Kentucky, and the plants are grown here on the farm. Richard helps me load the items into my truck, and then we head to the greenhouse for some plants. As he pulls some raspberry roots from a tub of damp sawdust, I notice the number of bees that are around us.
We have bees on the Berea Urban Farm. We have three different kinds of hives. We have the Langstroth hive, which is the most common hive for bees. We have the top bar hive, and we have the Layens hive. It takes, to make a pound of honey, takes about a million visits to flowers by those bees. These bees are foraging, and they'll go out 2 to 5 miles from the hive to bring back nectar and pollen.
Which means that these same bees may actually show up in my own backyard, thanks to my new pollinator patch. If you're thinking about an alternative lawn care option, you can find more on creating your own sustainable gardens and lawns at sustainableberea.org. To be or not to be, that is the real question. For Eastern Standard, I'm Crystal Jones.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and Google News. Our Rise documentary series about Eastern Kentucky is available online at weku-rise.org. It's also on Spotify and Apple Music. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.